The best in men's clothing. Call Paul's Boutique and ask for Janice, and the number is 718-498-1043. That's Paul's Boutique, and they're in Brooklyn. At the height of our collective mixtape making and sharing era, I used to put a commercial I recorded off the radio on tapes I made for Adam and Mike. It was an ad for a clothing store in Brooklyn called Paul's Boutique. For whatever reason, we loved the commercial and thought it'd be funny to put it on our record, which ultimately we titled Paul's Boutique. Unfortunately, the actual store closed down not long after our record came out. I don't think the two incidents were related in any way. I hope not. There's no way, right? That'd be crazy. Anyways, unbeknownst to me and Mike, Yout contacted the phone company, paid some kind of fee, and took ownership of Paul's Boutique's phone number. He had it routed to an answering machine in the basement of his parents' house in Brooklyn. He left some kind of outgoing message that was basically, "Hey, it's Paul. Things are pretty busy around here lately, so I'm not sure when I can get back to you, but leave a message anyway. Thanks." He would check the machine every now and then when he'd visit his parents. Is that the fucking best or what? He told me and Mike about it a couple months after he did it, and obviously we were like, "Oh, this is your greatest achievement ever." And so, one day, while skimming through the message tape, Yauk was intrigued by a message left by a gentleman named Alan. The phone message was so bizarre that we loved it and put it on our third record, Check Your Head, before the song The Maestro, and it is as follows.
"Yo, Paul, this is Alan. You can kiss my ass. I ain't interested in you anyhow. I'm just interested in the B-boys. So fuck you, my man."
Now, I'm not sure I understand. How and why would Alan have thought that that message would get to us? Did he think that we put the commercial on our record because we were part owners of the boutique? Did he think that maybe one of us might have answered the phone when he called? I believe that deep down in his mind, body, and spirit, Alan knew that the message he was leaving was for someone named Paul, a gentleman who owned a store in Brooklyn that boasted it had the best in men's clothing. But really, though, how would it have made Paul feel to hear that message? It'd be 10:15 in the morning. He'd have just met Janice out front, or maybe they'd arrived together, not to start any gossip or anything. Together, they'd roll up the huge metal security gate, unlock the door to the store, turn the lights on, do some general getting ready for another day of business stuff, you know, listening to the answering machine to see if there were any deliveries for today, maybe a special order, but what they'd get that morning instead would be a slurry, Robitussin-induced message from a stranger that says, "Fuck you, my man." What the fuck, Alan? I mean, come on. It turns out, when you put a phone number on a record that 500,000 people own, there's going to be more than a few who decide to call it up. After a while, shit got pretty hot. The answer machine's cassette tape would fill up, causing the phone line to have a busy signal for weeks at a time. But people kept calling. The messages started to get pretty heavy, and then started to not make any sense. Yauk realized that someone had cracked the 4-digit code to the answering system, and was now not only able to listen to the messages other people would leave, but could change the outgoing message, too. Some anonymous person created some crazy-ass outgoing messages. They got pretty fucking hostile. Yauk would change the outgoing message, only to have it changed again the next time he'd listened to it. He'd unplug the machine for a while, plug it back in 6 months later, only for more weirdness. So he left the machine off for years. Every once in a while it would come out of retirement for a couple of weeks, and maybe, just maybe, it still does.
Toyota Corolla Mixtape by Adam Horovitz, read by Josh Hamilton. Back in 91, my girlfriend Ione had a really beat-up burgundy Toyota Corolla. We went a lot of places and had some weird and fun times together in that car. All four doors were different colors because they'd been replaced over time due to several big dents either she or I had made. It had graffiti, stickers, and trash all in it. The whole car started to shake if you drove over 50 miles per hour. I loved it. I drove it to the studio every night. It was basically my home office. Ashtray piled over, 200 Del Taco wrappers in the back seat where your feet go. The car's stereo was busted, so I just had a box in there. I also kept a guitar and a Casio keyboard in there, just in case. It was a young, fun, and creative time. I had a rotating stack of tapes that I'd listened to when I drove from my house up to Mulholland Drive and over and through the Hollywood Hills to G-Sun. Here are a few songs I was listening to then. Come Along, Lee Scratch Perry. The greatest. People love Kanye because he produces and raps, and they should because he's fantastic, but give this song a listen when you get a sec. It'd help if you were super stoned and driving in the mountains in 80-degree weather with the windows rolled down. This whole Upsetters Chapter 1 album is great, too. The song Bushweed Corn Trash is another gem. The song was mixed to have the vocals on one side and all the music on the other, so I could be a DJ rocking an imaginary crowd while driving on a Hyperion Boulevard. Turn the left-right knob all the way left to drop out the music, and you just got Lee Perry on the mic. Turn it all the way to the right, and the crowd keeps dancing. People Funny Boy, Lee Scratch Perry. Yes, another Lee Perry song, but I was really into Lee Perry then. And now. Croaking Lizard, Prince Jazbo. Just a great space-out jam, one of those ones that's magical. I love reggae so much, but I've always been nervous to try to perform it myself. Like Bob said, if you explain to musicians, they know it, but they can't do it. There's not that many people who make you wonder when you hear their voice, not just what they're like, but what it would be like to be them. Sly Stone, Ari Up, a handful of others. Prince Jazbo was one of those people. I had no idea what he was like. And especially as a musician, I hear 98% of recorded music, and I understand how it was made. I can picture the person or people making it, but Prince Jazbo? I gotta stand for something. Professor and the Efficiency Experts. I got this 45 from Skate Master Tate, rest in peace, via my friend Max Perlick. Look this shit up and you'll see why this song was such a big deal to me. If I was a different person, one that could sing and play an instrument really well and make great sounding records, this is what I would have wanted all my records to be like. Similar song, similar idea, Misdemeanor, Foster Silvers. Plantagenet, Backdoor. This shit is just real, real funky. And it's nice and short like a punk song, the way great songs ought to be. Sweetie Pie, Stone Alliance. This is actually not that great of a song. It's funky, for sure, but way too long. It's just, I got it at the height of our record collecting days, and so it went into heavy mixtape insertion. And when it came on, I most likely just spaced out and looked out over the Hollywood Hills. Mr. Brown, Bob Marley and the Wailers. This is just a great song, and oddly, or not oddly, very punk. Fried Neck Bones and Some Home Fries, Willie Bobo. In the midst of digging deep into dirty record crates, we discovered these new and awesome sounds that were there all along. I'm sure we heard it 1,000 times when we were kids in New York, but who knew about Boogaloo? It's the fucking best. Honorable mixtape mention, Soul Sauce by Cal Chater, and Mira Beneka by Johnny Colon. And over the next few years, all three of us got deep into Boogaloo and Samba and other types of Latin sounds. Answer the Phone, Cheech and Chong. All great mixtapes and or pause tapes have skits on them. Cheech and Chong delivered some of the greatest of all time. New Bell, Manu Dibango. This is how I wanted to play guitar, and this is what I wanted our instrumental music to sound like. Honorable mention for guitar playing, House of Rising Funk by Afrique, and Tippy Toes by The Meters. P.S. I love Eddie Hazel. Give It Up or Turn It Loose, Dick Hyman. If you just found this record for a dollar and brought it home and listened to it, it would blow your mind too. Old 60s electronic music guy doing a James Brown classic? Yes, please. I Walk on Gilded Splinters, Dr. John. Right Place, Wrong Time was the jam when we were kids, of course. But as I got older and deeper into music and records, The Meters' Dr. John connection put me on to Dr. John. This is a burnout classic. You Are the One for Me, Charles Wright. Just a fresh cookie from the jar, baked and crate dug. The Humpty Dance, Digital Underground. Needs no explanation, right? It's one of the greatest songs ever recorded since the invention of music. Lovely Is Today, Eddie Harris. For whatever reason, I decided that Eddie Harris was my hero. This song is what led me to that decision. I didn't own all his records. I didn't actually know anything about him. I wouldn't hear his record, The Reason Why I'm Talking Shit, for another year or two. It was just this song and his song Drunk Man that did it. Well, Actually, a big factor in that decision is the cover of the record that Loveliest Today is on, Plug Me In. In the picture on the cover of the record, he's holding his saxophone in one hand, and in the other, he's pushing a Maestro FX pedal toward the camera. I have one of those. I bought it at this used music store in Larchmont in L.A. that me and Mike used to go to. The store is long gone, as is anything old on Larchmont. This pedal looked cool to me, but I never really gave it its due until my hero, Eddie Harris, told me to plug it in.
The Diabolical Biz Markie by Adam Horovitz, read by Ben Stiller. Yo, you know where there's a candy store? That was the first thing Biz Markie said to us when he first came to G-Sun to work together. We didn't really know him or what he was about, so we didn't know what that meant. Was it code for drugs or for actual candy? Turns out he meant actual candy. Like, before we got started, he needed to have Tootsie Rolls, a Butterfinger, and maybe some jelly beans. Asking for a candy store seemed really specific and odd. For one, it was nighttime when he arrived, so you'd assume that a candy store would be closed by then. And at that time, Atwater, where our studio was a dead neighborhood. We told him that the only thing open around us was a liquor store across the street called Copper Keg, and they might have, like, a Snickers or something. So off he went. A fantastic introduction, if you ask me. Sober, grown-up rappers that need to have candy right away. In rap, you're weird if you don't have a bunch of guest rappers on your record. We never really did that. I guess up until the early 90s, no one really did that. It's not like Stiv Bators would guest on a Blondie track or Josie Wales would do a verse on a Bob Marley song. We loved the Biz and thought it would be so cool to hang out with him and make something weird together. I did not expect Biz to be as Biz-like as he was. Let's just say, as an artist, the Diabolical Biz Markie is not about process. He is about as on the fly as you can be. You better have the tape rolling when the Biz is around. He's an all freestyle, off the dome type of artist. The thing that we recorded and used of him on Check Your Head happened like this. He grabbed a record off the shelf in the studio and was like, "Yo, this record has a crazy beat on it. Give me a mic." Mario hits record, and as the record is playing, the Biz just freestyles. "The Beastie Boys, they are coming home. They're coming home. Whoa, they're coming home." For us, this was a truly magical moment. He came by the studio a couple more times and we would hang out, eat together, play basketball. Biz playing sports is a spectacle. And make music. We'd be playing our instruments and he'd just shout out random songs for us to play so he could sing them. "Yo, play the Beatles Yesterday." "We don't know how to play that." "Yo, Seals and Croft." "Seriously, what?" It was great that he assumed that since we were musicians, obviously we'd know how to play Captain and Tennille's Love Will Keep Us Together. It was like this weird dream of being able to perform his 7-year-old AM radio greatest hits. Footnote about the Biz. If you mentioned any item, he'd say he had it. Still sealed in the original packaging. "Rock'em Sock'em Robots." "Yo, I got those." "Grover Washington Jr.'s Mr. Magic." "Two copies, sealed." Well, apparently he didn't have Parliament's Rhenium record, because he borrowed mine, and I never got it back.
In 93, when I asked Biz if he had a cassette tape of mine that we'd been listening to together in my blacked-out Volvo station wagon, Biz replied with one of our top 20 most favorite quotes. "If you don't have it, I probably got it."
But probably my favorite of all our Biz stories was when we were recording Hello Nasty. He was supposed to come down to the studio to do some stuff. He was running a little late and we got a call. "Yo, it's me, Biz. I'm downstairs in the car. I'll be right up." We didn't see or hear from him for another 2 years. The Diabolical Biz Markie.
Our New A&R Guy by Adam Horovitz, read by Wanda Sykes. I know it's not nice to clown people, but sometimes it just has to happen, right or wrong. I also know that most often clowning someone is a fucking boomerang. Case in point, 1991, our new A&R guy. By the time we were recording Check Your Head, everyone new at the record label had already been replaced by someone newer. There was now a new A&R guy, and he wanted to come to the studio to hear what we were making. Back to the clowning part. I know I'm an awful person, and that it's wrong to judge somebody just because of their personal style, but to me, unless you're riding a horse, I just don't think that you need cowboy boots in Hollywood. So, the breakdown of our new A&R guy's style goes like this. Cowboy boots, tight black jeans, leather jacket, dad style, long and straightened dyed black hair, driving a Porsche convertible, top down, everything. The guy that immediately gets picked in a police lineup for 80s Hollywood A&R guy douchebag. I'm sure he was really nice. It's just, we didn't give him a chance. He was just not on to what we were into. He seemed to be stuck in a lover boy, loving every minute of it moment, and just really wanted to keep his paychecks coming. New boots are pricey. So when our new A&R guy was on his way to our studio to hear what we'd been working on, we decided to go through all our tapes and select the most awfulest garbage we'd made so far to play for him. Like 11-minute super stone slow jams where you could hear her still playing music while someone just walks away and starts playing basketball. Or mid-11-minute space jam where a couple of us are having a conversation about ordering food while the rest are still playing. It was a really weird way to clown someone. We played these tracks and just waited for any kind of reaction. Nothing. After an hour or so, he was like, "Wow, you guys, that's some great stuff here. I'm really excited about this." And then he left. Who was more confused, him or us? Did he get to his car and think, "Shit, these guys suck. It's way worse than I thought. Someone's gonna get fired because of this dumb pothead jam band. And it might be me." I mean, what was he thinking? The music we played for him was way worse even than you're imagining it to be. Why did we do that? This person was supposed to be looking out for us, and we just so obviously clowned him. Why? It must have been the boots. Footwear is so very specific and fucking important, as is having a tight sock gang. When everything was done with Check Your Head, written, recorded, mixed, and mastered, we handed it off to the record label, to our new A&R guy. We didn't know if Capitol would tell us to wait again because fucking Whitesnake was back and their heat was hot. We had to go into the Capitol building a few days later to meet the A&R guy and to discuss the choice of the first single. What song and video would make the most impact and let the people know that Beastie Boys is about to make heads explode. We got to his office and he seemed way too relaxed. We were fucking amped up. We had a whole finished and ready to go record. We started talking about songs off the record and he was acting weird. He casually picked up the pre-release cassette tape and said, "I think Jimmy James should definitely be the first single. Nothing against that song. I really like it. It's just, it doesn't have a hook, a chorus. Most songs you hear on the radio, most of the songs you love have a chorus, a hook, the thing that reels you in and makes it so you can't help but sing, scream, or rap that damn chorus over and over. Jimmy James doesn't have that." We asked him about other songs and suggested, "So what you want as the first song to go with? If we're gonna come out, let's come out big, right?" Our new A&R guy kind of scanned the tape, looking at the track titles, and was like, "I don't know. I think Jimmy James is the one." We asked him if we could just play "So What You Want" for him and see what he thought. And he begrudgingly said, "Okay." Long, awkward moment where you have to fast forward and rewind a tape to find the beginning of the song you're looking for. A half a minute into "So What You Want," he's like, "Wow, what's this? I like it." He hadn't even ever listened to our record. He only just glanced at the tape and said Jimmy James because it was the title of the first song on the track list, because it was the nearest to him. He couldn't have given two shits about us. And you know what? Why should he? The fucking clowns just got clowned.
Check Your Head by Adam Horovitz. So after we found G-Sun and officially set up shop there, we started sifting through the tapes we'd recorded at the Cole practice space. You know, the stuff Mario recorded using those cool Radio Shack PZM mics. Most of the stuff on those tapes was garbage playing and us talking about where to order food from, but there were a couple gems hidden inside. On one particular tape was a long space-out jam that had a few sensational-sounding bars of playing on it. We sampled those bars on Mike's MPC-60 sampling drum machine, put them in a kind of arrangement. Yauch wrote a few lyrics, and we each took a turn singing those words. In a sample-y kind of way, we muted and unmuted the vocal takes that sounded good. The end result is the song Something's Gotta Give. It certainly is odd that a 3.5-minute song would take 2.5 years to finish, but that's how this record was made. Like, you'd make a dough, then put it on top of the fridge for a while to rise. You'd make a sauce, add ingredients, let them sit together and coalesce into deliciousness, and then you get where I'm going with this, right? I'm making a 2-year-old pizza.
Pass the mic. Yauch was on a mission. He was standing in the middle of the live room at GSUN, directing traffic. We were several months into the recording of Check Your Head. The process had been loose but productive. We'd never made a record like this. We knew how to play, and we knew how to sample and program and scratch and MC, but doing all of the above was uncharted territory. We didn't know what we were doing, in the best way possible. There was a lot of experimentation, which was what Yauch was consumed with that day. We'd been fans of John Bonham's booming drum sound long before we became associated with that sound on License to Ill. Now that we'd resolved to play our own instruments, we wanted to create that sound ourselves. The GSUN Live Room was a ginormous ballroom, by New York City standards, certainly big enough to give us the reverb and echo we needed, so why couldn't we? But just recording the drums in the room didn't make them sound big enough. Let's put the drums in the middle of the room, Yauch said, so the sound bounces everywhere. We pulled the drums down off the stage and set them up in the middle of the floor. Better. More room sound and reverb for sure, but still definitely not big enough. It needed to knock people over and break speakers. Yauch grabbed a bunch of empty cardboard boxes still lying around from when we moved in. We broke them down and then refashioned them into a long cardboard tube about 10 feet long and the same diameter as a kick drum. We put one opening of the tube flush against the kick drum and duct taped it there. Then Yauch had Mario place a couple of mics inside the tube itself and one at the open end of it. It was like the scene from Apollo 13 where they had to make a carbon dioxide filter out of plastic bags, cardboard, and duct tape. Once this was all set up, I played the drums for a while and headed into the control room to listen back. The sound was epic. Truly huge. We had it. Who thinks of things like this? Adam Yauch, that's who. Was there some kind of using cardboard to get better drum sounds manual I hadn't read? And the whole time he was acting like, yeah, this'll work. And it did. His self-confidence was both necessary and contagious. That big drum sound, made from the magic of cardboard, is what you hear on Pass the Mic.
Gratitude. Yauch's Univox Superfuzz distortion pedal was more than an object, a keepsake, or a cool piece of music gear he liked to have around. For him, this fuzz box had a life of its own, a personality. When he played his bass through this box, it was as though he'd transform into this other being, a much grimier and badass person. He's a great musician and can play the acoustic and electric bass fantastically without it. But when Mr. Superfuzz showed up, shit got different. This song features that distortion pedal, and really, it's about being thankful for the simple things. Love and friendship and life. And dumb little objects that make us human. So what you want? Every rapper on the planet has publicly denounced biting, yet we all do it. You can't rap and not have Spoonie G, Biggie Smalls, or Melly Mel in the back of your head. Trust me, if you're rapping, you're biting Sha Rock whether you know it or not. So kids, if you're gonna bite, do it right. But biting is not a crime. No, that's not a lead into a Marv Albert joke. All musicians, artists, writers, etc. get inspiration from some other musician, artist, writer, etc. But there can be a fine line between biting and stealing. But really, there's 1,000 songs where the music goes dunk, da-dunk, dunk, da-dunk. So to me, biting the Southside Movement song I've Been Watching You is not a crime. I had a little setup in a big empty closet at GSUN that we called Studio G. It consisted of a turntable, a DJ mixer, speakers, and my SP-1200 sampler. I was chopping up, sampling, that Southside Movement song for a potential song of ours. And that shit sounded fucking great. I added some kicks and snares. Dunk, cack, da-dunk, cack, dunk, cack, da-dunk, cack. I looped it up and we put that shit on blast. Listened to it over and over again. And while we were writing lyrics, someone, I'm sure it was Yauk, said, "Why don't we just bite this and play it ourselves? I mean, we were playing our instruments all night, every night already. Why not give it a try?" When you think about it, you've heard that dunk, da-dunk in a ton of other songs. But once Money Mark started to play his organ with our guitar, bass, and drums, it sounded different. It sounded a little sampley, a little sloppy, and kind of funky. And it was now ours. We added our distorted microphone style, and we changed the course of history forever. Or at the very least, we made a banger for you to blast.
Time for Livin'. This was the hardest song to write lyrics for. We liked the music and wanted to include it on the record, but lyrically, we were at a loss. We'd been listening to a lot of Sly and the Family Stone. On a Small Talk album, there's a song called Time for Livin'. We play that in the studio all the time, put the vinyl record on when we were playing basketball and whatnot. So one day, everyone kept pushing me to record something, anything for vocals on this hardcore song. I got frustrated and just went in and sang the lyrics to the Sly Stone song verbatim through a karaoke mic. We were feeling pretty hesitant about doing vocals, and up to a certain point, Check Your Head was entirely instrumental. These karaoke mics were ceremoniously given to us one day by Mario C., who randomly found them in a music store. When he presented them to us, it was like some kind of CGI effect of glistening diamonds and rainbows happened as a heavenly, soundtrack came on. These mics distorted our voices in just the right way, making us instantly comfortable, just freestyling, talking mad shit, and whatever. You could just go off, and we sure did. Anyway, the Time for Livin' version wasn't intended to be the final vocal, just a placeholder. But then we listened back, and later thought it was kind of good. So we kept the vocal as is, and partially credited the song to Sly Stone in tribute.
The Blue Nun. This one is self-explanatory because Blue Nun is a delicious beverage. Stand Together. Oh my goodness, this song was going to drive me nuts. I love it, don't get me wrong, it's just, we recorded Mario drilling a screw into a piece of wood because we wanted to have that be a funny and odd percussion sound. Which it is, but when you make a record, you end up hearing the songs 1,000 times because of writing and recording and mixing and mastering and performing and so on. I've heard my least favorite Beastie Boys song, What Comes Around, 100 times more than I've heard one of my all-time favorite songs, Kleenex by Generation X, just because I had to. Anyways, for this song, Mario recorded Yauk playing a ton of Univox Superfuzz guitar. Then he played that recorded guitar from the mixing console out and into a DJ mixer, and then back out of the DJ mixer and into a different track on the mixing console so we could re-record the guitar through that DJ mixer. Yauk wanted to do this because the mixer had a little switch that could cut the sound off and on when you wanted to. It's known to DJs as the Terminator switch. When a record's playing through a mixer and a DJ is cutting the sound off and on really fast, it's called terminating. If none of this is making sense, either I'm an awful describer or you know zero about DJing. I blame you. Yauk recorded his guitar playing knowing that he wanted to terminate it after it was recorded. He wanted to have the end result become this new and fragmented recreation of what once was, a chopped up cyborg of the original. Although it took hours and hours to record, it was like watching someone who loves to play video games play video games. The end result sounds amazing to me. And it was all for the common cause of experimentation. Yauk's big idea for this one was, I want to make a rap song with crazy terminated fuzz guitar that has super positive lyrics. Something about, like, stand together. Okay, let's do it. Mark on the Bus. We were still getting to know Mark Nishida, and I guess he was going through a transitional phase during this time. He briefly went under the moniker Keyboard Liquor Mark, always drinking wine. We met practically every night at the studio, and unbeknownst to us, he sometimes spent the night there, on the couch. His drive back to Gardena was a long one, especially at 3:26 a.m., and two bottles of wine deep. He'd do the safe thing and just crash on the couch. Anyways, Mark was the best musician of the four of us. We'd never played with a piano player before, and something about that instrument made things sound a little more like real music. And when he broke out his clavinet, he was on some Stevie Wonder shit. Also, Mark is the only one of us who could actually sing a song without sounding like a toddler. We showed up at the studio one night, and Mark played us a song that he'd recorded the night before after we'd all gone home. He must have done it at, like, 4 in the morning. He had recorded all the instruments and vocals by himself, drunk as a skunk. Even though he wrote and recorded everything, and we had pretty much nothing to do with it, it's one of my favorite songs we ever made. Professor Booty. There's nothing outrageously remarkable about this song. We just looped a beat and wrote lyrics. We switched back and forth with our rhymes so often that we each wanted to take a verse for a change. It's dumb and funny and the music is funky. What else do you want? But on a side note, we played a festival in the late 90s, somewhere in the world, and this older gentleman approached me and asked if I was in Beastie Boys. I said, yes, why? He said that he wanted to thank me. For what? He said that we sampled his music and that he actually got paid for it. He said that his music had been sampled a bunch of times and he rarely received clearance or payment. Of course I asked, who are you? And he said, I'm Willie Henderson. I knew right away who he was. We sampled his song Loose Booty for this song. Professor Booty. I was like, oh shit, no way. Oh man, come on, thank you. In Threes. This was one of the last songs we recorded for this record. We were starting to lock into each other's playing style. We were starting to have a style. A new style. This song started because someone, not me, casually said, hey, let's play something in threes instead of 4-4 time. Mike started playing a beat, Yout came up with a bass line, I got my wah-wah going, and Mark got busy with his clavinet. It was coming together and it felt fun, like playing funky hardcore. Note to self, please don't say funky hardcore. But we didn't know where to take it after that. We decided to take this other, slower thing that we recorded sometime earlier and scotch tape it to the end. Mario muted all of the instruments and echoed out the guitar part to have it blend into this new old ending part. Done and funky. Namaste. I'm assuming it's the same for everyone who makes records. Each record you make is like a time capsule. Looking back is a marker for what was going on in your life then. That phase. And this song was a perfect way to end this record. It ends with more of a comma than an exclamation point. We were all going through life changes, but Yauch was in a full-on transformation. He had started learning about and practicing Buddhism. He was traveling the globe any chance he got, India, Nepal, Tibet, Egypt. He needed to soak up every experience he could. He left Los Angeles and didn't really have a home. He was spending a lot of time in Utah snowboarding. He was all over the place, but in a really thoughtful, balanced, and introspective way. He was making new friendships in the form of Tibetan monks and knucklehead snowboarders. He would hang with anyone so long as they were fun. His demeanor had an odd, thrilling calmness. One night at the studio, he said that he had some thoughts that he had written down, not lyrics, and he'd like to try saying them over an instrumental track that we had waiting for just this occasion. And like most of the songs on this record, we were like, okay, if you want to take the lead, go ahead. And so this song kind of tells us where he was at and where he was headed.
Kiss the Monkey on the Nose by Adam Horovitz. Read by Bette Midler. Just before Check Your Head was released, me, Yauch, and Mike did a photo shoot for some magazine. We were in promo mode, doing tons of interviews, photos, and generally whatever it is you do to let people know that you have a new, purchasable product in the marketplace. So for this particular photo shoot, we went to some random photo studio somewhere in L.A., and it was like something off a TV show or movie. Straight Zoolander. Can I get you some water, flat or sparkling? Cold or room temperature? Espresso? There's a DJ playing crappy music. There are a lot of people hanging around for just one person to take pictures of three dudes. So, Someone brings us into a room and says that the photographer has picked out a few different looks for us to wear. No offense, but we already picked out our looks when we got dressed this morning. As schlubby as we've always been, that is all our own doing. No stylist has ever picked out our shitty t-shirts and pants. But this guy has rented animal costumes, Roman centurion outfits, weird fashionable clothing, etc. We try to explain that we really just want to take the pictures of us how we are. That's kind of our thing. The photographer hears about it and comes in looking a little heated. He is a kind of bigger, older, Swiss gentleman. We start explaining that all we need is someone to take some pictures so we can be in a magazine and sell records, and you know what I mean. We're only here for spieling purposes, generally.
Mike Watt of Minutemen and Firehose referred to all band promotional activity as spieling.
He is Swiss and pissed. Why don't you wear the animal costumes? I say, look, if you take a bunch of pictures of us with the clothes that we came in here wearing, I'll put on the gorilla mask, and we can take a few pictures like that. Compromise. Everyone's happy. He calms down. A little. We start chit-chatting while people are setting up whatever they needed to set up. Because this guy is Swiss, Jauch starts talking about his uncle, Nathaniel Hornblower, the great and innovative Swiss film director. He's telling him about his early experimental work in the 50s, and how he's been living in seclusion in the mountains of the Appenzell region on the Swiss-Austrian-German border. Now the photographer is interested and we're okay with him. We start taking the pictures and it's fine. He starts getting a little animated, like a fashion photographer in a movie. We take a break for a minute so I can put the gorilla mask on. We resume poses and pictures. The photographer is loving it. He's shouting at us over the house music. Action! More action! Move around! Jump up and down! Do something with your hands! More action again! Get closer! Kiss the monkey on the nose! Wait. What? Kiss the monkey on the nose! We stop dead. What do you want us to do? What? He screams at us over the blasting dance music that he wants Adam and Mike to be on either side of me and that they should kiss my gorilla mask on the nose. Game over. I take the mask off. We start thanking him for all his hard work and for the room temperature water, and we leave. That experience left a big impression on us, though. It gave us a new phrase and framework for selling out. Kissing the monkey on the nose.
Hey, We Should Put That Out by Michael Diamond. At first, Grand Royal was just a logo and a vague notion. When we signed with Capitol, the only other labels we'd been on were Rat Cage and Def Jam. Both of them had an us-against-the-world, anti-establishment outlook, even after Def Jam partnered with CBS, and we fed off of that. Capitol Records, on the other hand, was the establishment. We were never 100% comfortable with that, so as part of our deal, we negotiated the right to put our records out on our own label within Capitol. No, we didn't have a label or intend to start one. Instead, we spent a bunch of time coming up with a name and logo for our non-existent label and slapped both on Check Your Head. Look, we got a label. The logo proves it. The name Grand Royal and accompanying catchphrase, guaranteed every time, were copped from Biz Markie, who said both into the mic, probably after consuming half a bag of candy. Sometime right after Check Your Head came out, we got a cassette of demos from a couple of old friends, Jill Kniff and Gabby Glazer, two of the original Bag Ladies. Their band was called Luscious Jackson. Jill asked if we could help with getting the demo to people to see if a label might be interested in putting it out. At that point, the three of us were becoming slightly less self-involved, meaning that instead of ignoring such requests, we actually wanted to help our friends if we could. So we listened. The demo was really good. It had elements of hip-hop, sampling beats, looping stuff, but was definitely not a rap demo. It was fresh, unlike anything else out at the time, with musical references that we all appreciated. I was trying to think of what record labels to send it to when Jauch just said, "Hey, we should put that out ourselves." Of course, this was Jauch's idea. He was definitely the most generous of the three of us, and he was always undeterred by thinking big. At the same time, he and we didn't think of it as just helping friends. He genuinely loved the music and thought it deserved to be heard. I told Jill our idea, and she accepted. Just like that, Grand Royal was an actual record label. Immediately, we are confronted with the next inescapable fact. We had zero infrastructure, and even less of an idea of what we were doing. Actually, wait. We had this kid named Max. Long story short, when we couldn't get the lyrics for Check Your Head to fit on the cassette insert, we promised anyone who sent us a self-addressed stamped envelope that we'd send them back a printed lyric sheet. This seemed cool in theory, but way more people wrote in than we expected. We actually had to hire someone to deal with it, and that someone was Max. Besides Max, though, we had zero else. So while Luscious Jackson tweaked the recordings that would become their debut EP, we had to figure out how to manufacture, distribute, and promote a record. We'd seen hardcore bands do it. How hard could it be? Answer, really fucking hard. Pretty quickly, we managed to figure out the easy part, getting the LP, CD, cassette manufactured. It was an 8-song EP, In Search of Manny. The finished version was even better than the demo, and as a cosmic bonus for us, our old drummer, Kate Schellenbach, whom we'd rather shittily kicked out of the band 8 years before, had joined Luscious Jackson. It wouldn't make up for how we had treated her, but maybe we could start repairing a friendship at least. The EP came out, and people liked it, which alone was gratifying. We hadn't totally failed our friends, but the actual release of a record is only the beginning of a label's work. What good is it if people hear about a record but can't find it in a store? Online sales and online piracy were still many years away. We had no fucking idea that all these little record stores all over the world had to be called and told that a new record was out and which distributor they could get it from. Even worse, we had no idea how to get paid by independent record distributors, nor did we understand for most of them their business model was only to pay the people they absolutely had to pay. But even before any of that, we had to solve the biggest, most basic problem, finding ways for people to hear or hear about the record so they'd want to buy it in the first place. Pre-internet, there were only a handful of ways that people could experience new music, hearing it on the radio, in a record store, or at a club, or reading about it in the press. Each of these avenues of exposure had its own subculture and its own gatekeepers. We also stumbled upon another way to communicate with people about the music we were putting out. In his broom closet turned office, Max had this super primitive early Mac computer. Whenever he'd get one of those self-addressed stamped envelopes for Check Your Head lyrics, we somehow had the foresight to enter the person's name and address into a master spreadsheet. This gave us something that once we started a record label suddenly became invaluable. Data. Data that we could theoretically use to tell all these people that we had an awesome new record by Luscious Jackson coming out. Today, this kind of mailing list-driven direct marketing is so common that it's taken for granted. But it wasn't common at all in those days. Certainly a bunch of dipshits in a band and a kid in a broom closet wouldn't have thought to create such a database. Instead, through the random, possibly bad decision of promising lyrics in the mail, a database just fell into our lap. Since we are already mailing lyric sheets to these folks, somebody came up with the idea of also sending a newsletter that would inform the recipient what we were up to, both in the band and with Grand Royal. The idea felt incredibly practical and incredibly boring, but instead of just bagging the idea and moving on, we talked ourselves into something way bigger and more ambitious. Let's make a magazine that covers all the kinds of stuff that we're into. The truth was, we weren't just interested in producing some Xerox fanzine. We wanted our shit to look legit, like a real magazine, like a cross between Spy and The Face and Thrasher, with the humor of Monty Python and Mad Magazine. So, we decided to do it. Once again, we had absolutely no idea what the hell we were getting ourselves into. I mean, the premise of covering topics we were interested in seems straightforward enough, but the logistics of producing an actual magazine were way beyond any of us. The first order of business was finding an editor. I can't remember exactly how we ended up hiring Bob Mack. What I do remember is that he'd written a Spin magazine article about us that in his mind was flattering. In our minds, it was not. But that's kind of how Bob's mind works. He's also inspired and idealistic, so we hired him and gave him an office. Reed, desk in another broom closet at GSUN. Soon we discovered a problem. For Bob, deadlines were like a totally alien concept. Moving target would be generous. Pretty quickly, we found ourselves in the unlikely position of having to tell someone else they had to quit messing around and actually finish something. I wish I could say it worked. Often our days went something like this. We'd walk into the studio at our regular-ish, afternoon-ish time and decide to check in with Bob to see what had been happening all day on the magazine front. We'd enter Bob's office to find him in a hacking cough fit from doing one or several overly large bong hits. Every inch of his desk was completely littered with random papers, so there was no visible writing surface. We'd ask him for updates. He'd give us vague, evasive answers, and eventually we'd have to take him to task. Somehow, we put out our first issue. The cover story was about Bruce Lee, and our man Bob really went deep. Beyond the piece about Bruce himself, we thought it would be cool to interview Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about the 4 years he spent learning martial arts from Lee, and somehow, miraculously, Bob made it happen. All of a sudden, there I was, interviewing one of my all-time heroes. Dreams becoming a reality. Crazy. Now we are all hooked. We wanted the next issues to tell even more elaborate stories. Bob was determined to track down the reclusive Lee Scratch Perry, and he eventually did, finding him in a rural alpine region of Switzerland. He became our cover story for issue number 2, which came out a year late. In future issues, we researched Moog synthesizers, made free flexi discs and posters as inserts, staged a verbal confrontation between Bob Mack and Ted Nugent, and even at one point built a demolition derby car that we entered and drove in an actual demolition derby. Another great thing about all this was that we were able to involve a ton of talented and creative co-conspirators. Spike Jones shot photos. Andy Jenkins, art director for Dirt Magazine, designed GR before handing over the reins to artist Jeff McFetridge. On the label side, a kid named Kenny the Tick Salcido, who started as an intern, would show up before anyone in the morning with a big gulp-sized 7-Eleven coffee to keep amped while he called radio stations all over the country to beg for airtime. Miwa Okamura, now a successful music executive, dealt with the record stores. And then there were the bands we released. Luscious Jackson. Solo albums by Sean Lennon and Ben Lee. To this day, Buffalo Daughters 303 Live can hang with songs by Can or Silver Apples. Atari Teenage Riot was on some crazy ahead-of-its-time shit that combined the energy, noise, and raw power of hardcore punk with glitched-out digital music. We also released a few of our own side projects. A hardcore EP, Aglio e Olio, and Adam Horovitz's BS2000 and DFL, Dead Fucking Last. Looking back, most people who start labels or magazines usually have a manifesto, a specialized focus, or, you know, just a basic business plan. We had none of those things. All we had was the energy to dive in and keep things going until exhaustion or combustion overtook us. It was a blast at first, making cool shit with a bunch of creative people, running around in our studio and out at shows, going from a single employee who answered fan mail to a full-blown operation that released records and a magazine was all-consuming for everyone who worked with us. We definitely never made money and probably lost a good amount, but that was never the point. Eventually, though, we realized it was spreading us too thin. Fundamentally, all we cared about was being in a band. To become publishers and label executives was never part of the plan. The magazine eventually petered out after 6 issues. With the label, there got to be too many chefs in the kitchen, with too much money being spent to have any real fun. We drifted far off course from the fun and creative reasons we'd started it. Grand Royal had become like any other business. We had to sell records and magazines to survive. We became disenchanted and finally closed it all down in 2000, so we could refocus on the only thing that really mattered, making music.
The Girl in the Band, or Goodbye to You and Your Inflatable Penis, Kate Schellenbach. In August 1984, I was 18 years old and still a Beastie Boy. I had just gotten back to New York from a month-long trip exploring the nightclub scene in Europe with my best friend, during which I proudly rocked my hand-screened Beastie Boys graffiti logo hoodie. Every day I wore my custom-made belt buckle with my rap name, Mate. I drunkenly tagged bathrooms all over Amsterdam, Berlin, Paris, and London with Beastie Boys NYC. Back in the city, I went out with my friends to the happening club at the time, Area, and ran into Mike, Adam, and Adam with Rick Rubin. I immediately noticed they were wearing matching black and red Puma tracksuits, matching Puma sneakers with fat laces, and most ridiculously, do-rags. Somebody told me Rick had bought everyone the outfits. I immediately recognized this as a tactical move to solidify the band and distance me from them. Rick had flat-out told me he didn't like the sound of women rapping, so I knew I'd never stood a chance with him. Yuck must have noticed my confusion. He pulled me into a dark hallway to have a talk and fill me in on what had been going on while I was away. They had been spending a lot of time with Rick, working on the raps and music, and he had convinced them that he could break them as the first ever white rap group. I rolled my eyes knowing what was coming next. Rick had given them an ultimatum. Their future as Beastie Boys was either going to be with him or with me. They'd chosen him. I was blindsided. I could feel the heat rising up my body into my face. I was not one for public displays of emotion, certainly not at a trendy nightclub. So I turned away and tried to hide what I was feeling. We had always been in this together. It didn't matter if one of us went off to college, if someone had a day job. We were Beastie Boys. These were my compadres. It had never mattered that I was a girl. Never mattered until Rick Rubin came into the picture. Yauk assured me this wasn't the end of our musical collaboration. We could continue to play our punk songs as the Young and the Useless, while the Beastie Boys continued to pursue rap fame. But looking at them in their ludicrously matching do-rags, trying to come off like some kind of breakdancing crew from the Bronx, I felt alienated and embarrassed. Deep down, I knew I didn't have the chops or the confidence to be part of a rap group, but I also didn't want to lose my band and, more important, my friends. I felt dizzy and no longer able to hide the tears welling up in my eyes. I ran to the bathroom to pull myself together. I had to find the friends I'd come with that night. I wanted to drink and get high and dance and try to forget what just happened. The next few months, the boys spent the majority of their time working with Rick, writing the raps and creating backing tracks. Yauk would proudly play me their demos, tripping out on the sub-bass sounds of the Roland 808 drum loop played backwards. As much as he and I continued to bond over music and sound, I knew I was losing my pals, who were more and more taking on Rick's meathead persona. When they were around him, they put on this hip-hop swagger, make sexist jokes, and act like knuckleheads. Their raps focused on the size of their dicks and how many girls wanted to fuck them. It was hard for me to accept this assholian behavior from these nerdy boys who had never overtly sexualized me or any of the other girls in our scene. We continued to play our punk music and even did some recording together, but when Beastie Boys started making their first album, I stopped spending time with them and decided to focus on my college studies and my first girlfriend. License to Ill came out in the fall of 86, while my girlfriend and I were visiting her family in Miami. We bought a cassette of the album so we could listen to it in her mom's Bronco driving up to Disney World for my 20th birthday. When I first pushed play, I didn't know what to expect, and I was prepared to hate it. We listened to it over and over and thought it was hysterical. However offensive it was lyrically, sonically, it was brilliant, and we blasted it while driving around Florida. I was proud of my boys, but deep down I was sad not to be with them. Part of me was jealous of their success without me, but I had to accept the fact that I would never have fit into this version of the band. I mean, what would I be doing when they were rapping about fucking a girl with a wiffle ball bat? I think it still holds up as one of the funniest comedy records of all time. But I was in on the joke. Sadly, most of the world wasn't, and eventually even the Beasties forgot it was a joke. I groaned while watching them make fools of themselves on MTV's Spring Break special in Daytona. I heard secondhand tales of tour bus conquests, drunken hotel escapades, and prolific Budweiser can smashing. They'd invite me to their gigs when they played New York, but their live show featured a girl dancing in a cage and a giant inflatable penis, which my feminist brain really couldn't handle. This meathead mindset was the exact thing we made fun of and been disgusted by as young punks navigating New York City. So seeing them flourishing in this environment was hard to swallow. About a year later, after they finished touring, Yauk called me out of the blue. I hadn't talked to him on the phone in years, and I was excited and surprised to hear from my old friend. He wasn't trying to talk like a rapper. He was just his old self, and he confessed how miserable he was. He hated Rick. He wasn't getting along with Mike and Adam, who were siding with Rick, whatever that meant. They were being screwed by their label and their management. He missed playing his bass in a band. He missed playing with me and asked if I'd consider making music with him again. My mind was spinning with the possibilities, but we never ended up getting together. He started singing in a short-lived rock band called Brooklyn with the bassist from Bad Brains. I saw them play a show at The World and was amused by his choice of a cover song, Bachman Turner Overdrive's Taking Care of Business. We didn't connect again before the boys relocated to Los Angeles and left Rick Rubin and Def Jam behind. I was pretty out of touch with them by the time they released their sampling masterpiece, Paul's Boutique. I was really impressed with their musical output, and it became very clear to me that they had rejected their meathead ways and their fight for the right to party personas and were focusing on creativity. In 1991, I was devastated to learn about the death of Dave "Shoddy" Skilken, lead singer of The Young and the Useless, talented graffiti artist, and beloved mainstay in our downtown club scene. I saw the boys and many of our friends from our teen years at his funeral. Dave's death seemed to have knocked them all back into reality, and they seemed anxious to reconnect with their New York City friends from pre-rockstar days. Yauk and I went to lunch after the memorial, and he told me tales of living in L.A. He revealed that he, Adam, and Mike were back playing their instruments, and he was excited about the music they were going to do next. It felt great to be with him again and geek out about music, just like we did when we were teens. Around this time, a couple of girls I knew from the teen punk scene in New York, Jill Kniff and Gabby Glazer, recorded a brilliant lo-fi, sample-happy demo tape as Luscious Jackson. Pulling from many of the same influences as Beastie Boys, the songs were a mishmash of obscure samples, funky drum loops, humorous raps, and catchy choruses. They gave their cassette to the Beasties to get feedback and advice about what labels to send it to. The demo was such a big hit on the Beasties tour bus that Mike D wanted to make it the debut release of their new record label, Grand Royal. Mike wanted the girls to record a couple more songs. This is when Jill asked me to join the band, and I played with them on some live tracks for what became our debut EP, 1993's In Search of Manny. I was finally back where I was supposed to be, playing drums in a band made up of friends from this magical time in New York when punk rock crossed paths with hip-hop. I was reconnected with the Beasties in the most beneficial and holistic way, and each of them helped my band navigate the next decade of our music career. The Beasties had used their advance for Check Your Head to build their own recording studio in L.A. They were filming and directing all their own videos in charge of their marketing and output. They were growing their record label, launching a magazine, investing in a cool clothing line. We followed their model and tried to do the same, always fully in charge of our music, videos, marketing, publicity, logos, artwork, etc. Yauk's spiritual awakening was parlayed into a foundation supporting Tibetan rights. They were actively outspoken about women's rights. They publicly apologized for homophobic comments they made in the past. They gave me a shout-out in their Hall of Fame induction. It was an honor to be associated with the Beastie Boys and part of the Grand Royal family. People sometimes ask if the guys made any kind of formal amends, but I never felt like they owed me an apology. We were kids, we were all assholes, but we've always loved each other. And this went a long way for me, personally. I want to say a little something that's long overdue. The disrespect to women has got to be through. To all the mothers and the sisters and the wives and friends, I want to offer my love and respect till the end. Adam Yauk, Sure Shot, 1994. And no, I haven't ever run into that meathead, Rick Rubin.
I'll Just Call Him Mitchell, by Adam Horovitz, read by Maya Rudolph. I don't want to name names here, so I'll just call him Mitchell. Mitchell was a percussionist. He toured with us for a little while in the early 90s and recorded with us on a few songs, too. We met him at a percussion store not far from our studio and invited him to come down and play some music with us. We got a little insight into his psyche when he arrived at G-Sun and took out his three conga drums. He went into lengthy detail about how one was the mother drum, the other the father, and then with a special caress and fragile care, he whispered that this third one was indeed the baby drum. Mitchell seemed like a pretty intense, wound-up type of cat. Super positive, though, so much so that it seemed a bit much. Oh, also, he cried a lot. Whenever he had to have a difficult conversation, he'd get choked up and a little weepy. Mitchell missed the flight for his first gig on his first tour with us. He arrived the next day with an explanation.
What had happened was,
he was walking to the airport and was running late, and then these guys were eyeballing him and wanted to steal his gold chain, and, you know, and so one thing led to another, and he missed his flight. But bro, now I'm here and ready to play. There are a couple red flags in this story. One, no one, not anyone, ever has walked to the airport in Los Angeles. too. He wore the skinniest gold chain. It really wasn't the kind that you see someone wearing and think, that's a big chain to be wearing just walking around. But now he was here and ready to play, and we needed a percussionist, and he was actually really fucking good. It's weird to have someone you don't know that well playing on stage with you every night, but there was